Let's shift gears to another conversation from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Dr. Kenneth Davis is president and CEO of the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. It's a network of hospitals with 7 campuses and more than 39,000 employees. He's also a doctor who's participated in some breakthrough studies of Alzheimer's disease. We had a chance to sit down with him in Aspen and ask him about his leadership at Mount Sinai, particularly how it's been able to succeed in the face of growing challenges in the broader healthcare ecosystem.
First of all, what is the Mount Sinai Medical System? It was the Mount Sinai Medical Center, but you'll have to forgive me. I don't know the difference between a medical center and a medical system.
Right. Well, we've been growing. So we're now 8 hospitals, 300 ambulatory sites, 42,000 employees, and about a top-line revenue of $8 billion.
That's a lot of growth.
Big healthcare system.
Well, how did all that growth come about? Why the growth?
Well, it's a very hard business, the healthcare business, particularly in New York, where we have extraordinary competition. So we were, to begin with, before we became a larger system, a hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And our thought was, standing alone, we were not going to be able to really prosper. We had to have a much bigger footprint to be successful in healthcare. One of the systems that was looking to be taken over was something called the Continuum Healthcare System. They sought many partners. They ultimately did all their diligence, and they said, we will allow Mount Sinai to take us over. That and a few other hospitals in recent years have come together because unless you can decrease your expense structure, in an environment in which revenues do not keep up with expenses because the governments can't afford Medicare or Medicaid, you wind up with an insolvable equation unless you can really get much more efficient.
You're talking about things like government reimbursements for services?
Yes, Medicare and Medicaid. We're 62% Medicare and Medicaid. And every Medicaid patient that comes to our hospital, we lose 35 cents on the dollar. And every Medicare patient, we lose 15 cents on the dollar. So we have to find ways to be much more efficient.
So the competition in New York that you're talking about, or the competitive environment, it sounds like it's not just different hospital systems trying to vie for the same people saying, oh, come to this hospital. We have these specialists. We have these services. It's just being able to pay the bills and make the ends meet.
That's true. But we have a bizarre situation in the island of Manhattan. There are 3 hospitals that are on the U.S. News and World Report Honor Roll. That means the top 20 of 5,000-plus hospitals in the country. Those 3 are Mount Sinai, New York Presbyterian, and NYU. Additionally, there's this national brand in orthopedics, Hospital for Special Surgery, and the national brand in oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering. All of these places are within 3 miles of each other. There is no other place on planet Earth with that kind of competition in healthcare. Fortunately, we all have national reputations and international reputations so that we don't have to keep competing for the same people in New York City and the 5 boroughs and the surrounding suburbs. But it's very, very difficult because our expenses, our labor costs, our real estate costs, our construction costs, they're the highest in the country.
I understand that you oversaw in Mount Sinai one of the larger financial turnarounds in academic medicine. Talk about what Mount Sinai was like when you arrived and what needed to be done to turn it around.
Well, I'm the accidental CEO. My career had always been as a scientist, psychiatrist, who was interested in figuring out what was the biological basis of schizophrenia or Alzheimer's disease and developing therapeutics for those diseases. I was the dean for 2 months before the chairman of the board called me into his office because we were in very difficult times and said, we want you to be the CEO and the dean. And I paused. I'm not an MBA. This is not what I do. But I have a deep commitment to Mount Sinai and to all we represent. So I did it. And at that time, we had about 2 weeks worth of payroll that we had left. And we had $90 million of unrestricted funds in our endowment. And my strategy at that point was we had to grow our way out of this problem. We couldn't cut our way out of the problem. And we had a good brand, a good reputation. We had to use that $90 million to recruit some of the best specialists that we could bring who had the high-margin cases. High-margin cases are the complex surgeries. So we grew programs like orthopedics, like oncology, the stuff that we needed in order to survive. And we were successful at it.
Are these programs that are more, for lack of a better word, profitable than things like you know, just regular checkups or you know, pediatrics?
They have higher margins. You know, as a psychiatrist, I can tell you for decades I watched as our hospital is never adequately reimbursed for all the psychiatric care that we would do, so it loses money. Pediatrics, the same thing. Primary care, the same thing. So how do you do that? You cross-subsidize those with the stuff that is the high-margin business. The high-margin business, complex surgeries, transplants. So we had to grow those areas, and we did.
That's got to be hard on some levels as just a physician who wants to just make sure that all the care is taken care of, to have to say, oh, well, you're not as lucrative as this one, so we got to balance you with something else. That's got to be kind of tough.
It's very, very important that everyone is valued in the same way, despite what is the inequities in how we're reimbursed. So as a psychiatrist, I particularly appreciated that. I mean, I knew that the business that I was in, taking care of the chronic and persistently mentally ill, was not going to be making any money for anybody. But fortunately, all the leadership that we had, because this is a core value of the Mount Sinai Health System, never said to me, well, we really got to cut that service, or we really got to close that service down. In fact, you know, they rejoiced in the grants that we got, in the science that we were doing, in the therapeutics that we were developing, and they, you know, had great pride in us. I have to do the same thing with pediatricians, with primary care doctors, with other psychiatrists. We are all valuable in medicine today, and we can't make that sole value determined by how much you make for the hospital system.
Tell us a little bit more about Mount Sinai. If I'm a New Yorker and I'm thinking about Mount Sinai compared to, say, Presbyterian or NYU, what do you want me to think about when I think of Mount Sinai?
You know what? I want you to make the best decision for you. There are great doctors in all those places. I want you to do your homework if you really have a very serious condition and find out who are some of the best in the city or in the region to take care of you. What I want you to consider also is the following. If you've been a patient at New York Presbyterian or NYU or Mount Sinai for the better part of your life, for those great systems, there's no reason to leave. They have your records. They know who you are. They've been working with you for a long time. They'll probably be able to understand your comorbidities better than going to a new place that doesn't know you, and you'll get the best care that way.
Since these challenges are affecting Mount Sinai, they're affecting really every hospital system in the country, I'd be interested to know what you think about the current political debate around healthcare. Last year, we knew in the midterms, healthcare was the number one issue. The Google searches, every single time, healthcare was far and away the number one issue. Step away from the politics for a second and just talk to me about what you see as the head of a healthcare system in New York. Where are the big choke points, pain points? Where are the unresolved issues? From your perspective, what should we be really focused on right now?
Well, there are very few places in the world that can give you the therapeutics and the diagnostics of tomorrow. You got to have some kind of margin to be able to do that. The National Institute of Health, despite increases in its budget yearly, still is exceedingly competitive and relatively conservative in that they will look at a grant application and say, does the work conducted to date support the likelihood that this will be a successful grant? So they are not risk takers. And in a universe in which drug discovery has defaulted largely to a couple of dozen academic health centers, and drug development is in the hands of big pharma, we can't lose those leading academic medical centers if we still want to conquer, as is conquerable, with the breakthroughs that we have in biology and in, you know, the basic science of medicine. We will not conquer Alzheimer's, cancer, schizophrenia, opiate addiction, all the major burdens on our healthcare system if we don't have these few dozens of robust academic health centers.
More of our conversation with Dr. Kenneth Davis is just ahead. Stay close. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Kenneth Davis, the president and CEO of one of the nation's largest hospital networks, the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. We met at the Aspen Ideas Festival and talked about how to move forward with healthcare reform.
I was just going to ask you about Medicare for All. You know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are very strong proponents of it. Some of the other Democratic candidates say they either like it in part or they think it's a step in the right direction, but not quite right. There's also talk about a public option. There are, you know, most Democrats believe the Affordable Care Act or say that the Affordable Care Act should be, you know, protected and amended. Let's take these in pieces. First of all, Medicare for All, this idea that we do away with private insurance and make all health insurance paid for by the government. So you walk into a hospital, you get treated, you walk out, you never see a bill.
Right. Let me talk about the positives and the negatives. The positives are 97% of the money that goes into Medicare winds up in health care. By the Affordable Care Act legislation, either 85 or 80% of your premium winds up in health care. So what we know is, as much as people would want to scream, the government's inefficient, they're impossible, you don't want to use the government, their administrative cost is 3%. The insurance companies are 15 or 20. So that's a big deal. The other side of that is, if I have to live on, if Mount Sinai has to live on Medicare reimbursement, as my chief financial officer would say, somebody should take the keys. We're out of business. We then have to sit down and say, well, we're going to give the patients everything that they need, but how are we going to make sure that the hospitals can survive and to return to those academic medical centers that give us the focus of innovation, how do we make sure that they survive? Now, there are other payment structures that are really esoteric, like disproportionate share payments, how we calculate the wage index, all kinds of ways that we can get together and say, well, we're going to have to enhance that to these centers to make this work. It hasn't been a part of the dialogue. The reality is, whether it's been a Democratic or Republican administration, they go after those areas that I just talked about, those esoteric areas, because they have to cut costs. The government can't afford these systems. And it looks to them like the providers of care are doing quite well and we can take it all out of their hide. That's how we almost went bankrupt in 2002 and 2003. So it's a delicate balance that I'm afraid is not being adequately nuanced when people talk about Medicare for All.
I will say that the idea of Medicare for All, at least just from a purely political perspective, does have the benefit of reaching Americans in the pain of having to pay for health care. I think the idea is very, very alluring in that if you are just used to, first of all, having to figure out what the hell coinsurance is and copays versus premiums and all that other kind of stuff, and I thought I knew what it was, and then they sent me another bill. Just the idea of saying, you know what? This isn't going to be my burden anymore. Someone else, you handle this now. We're done. That's a very enticing just feeling.
It sure is. But we have to realize that there are some downsides as well. How do we afford it? I mean, we're going to have to find a way that taxpayers are going to be able to afford the kind of care that a Bernie Sanders talks about. Are we going to be able to stomach that? I am personally deeply committed to the notion that health care is a right, not a privilege, that everyone should be insured. I see the way to do that is to identify those people who are not insured, to bring back the mandate so they know they have to be insured, and then let them buy the public option. Let them buy into the system. Because there are lots of people who have pretty decent insurance, and they're saying, I don't want to change the way it works right now. And I can understand that. I don't think we need at this juncture a revolutionary change to make the system better. I'd like to first focus on how do we get everybody in this country insured so that healthcare is a right and not a privilege.
And does that public option look like Medicare? Does it look like something else?
I think it looks like Medicare. But then I want to sit down, you know, with CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, and sit down and say, now look, we've just added 10% more Medicare patients to our hospital system. And we can't keep losing 15 cents on the dollar on every one of those patients. So what are you going to do to keep us in business? What are you going to do so that all the patents that we generate every year in intellectual property, all the licenses, all the therapeutics that come from our pipeline continue. For example, the first new drug that has a new mechanism of action, a new way of dealing with depression for the first time in 70 years comes from Mount Sinai. It's ketamine. It's ketamine administered in a different way, in a different dose, but we found, after a lot of work, that this can be an antidepressant for those people who have been utterly treatment resistant. Now, this may seem a little esoteric, but all the previous antidepressants would do one of two things. They either block the reuptake of a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, so there's more epinephrine between the neurons, or they do it for serotonin, another neurotransmitter between the neurons. So we've been making the same drug for 70 years. We've got a new mechanism of action. In schizophrenia, there hasn't been a new mechanism of action since 1950-something when Thorazine was introduced, chlorpromazine. We've got to be able to continue to have innovation, and that innovation is going to come from academic medicine. And if academic medicine, like the Mount Sinai Health System and others like it, are starved by Medicare for All, we may have a short-term happiness and a long-term consequence.
With regards to treatments and medications, that's another aspect of the healthcare debate that's got a lot of Democrats and Republicans kind of in agreement in terms of drug prices. Talk about what you in a medical system see with regards to the cost of prescriptions, especially novel treatments, that we should keep in mind when we're thinking about what to do about drug prices.
I see a conundrum. And here's the nature of that conundrum. There has been data that suggests the following. Over the last 15 or 20 years, the loss of income due to big drugs going generic has been made up in big pharma, not by new drugs. New drugs have not been able to equal the lost revenue from patents that have expired, but by raising prices. So innovation has not been the fuel that we needed in big pharma to satisfy their stockholders. It's been raising prices. We don't want that to happen. So why are we losing innovation in big pharma? What are we going to do so that they can give us the kind of blockbuster drugs we need? So from my point of view, the problem is we are not developing the drugs that we need to cut healthcare costs and which will have the biggest impact on the world.
So I want to make sure I follow what you're getting at. Because drug companies will raise prices to make the books balance, it sounds like what you're saying is that being able to have a system where we can innovate, where we can create new treatments, has a significant effect on the overall cost of these drugs?
No. What I'm saying is, we've got to get the drug companies to make the drugs we need, and then we can fairly reimburse them because they'll be used by a huge number of people.
Gotcha.
But the question for me is, why isn't it happening? And the answer is because to try new novel mechanisms of action in large populations with difficult studies, with novel drugs, can take a lot of time in the pipeline. And when a company looks at that and they say, so how much patent life is left? They say, well, I may only have 5 years. But if I do this other drug over here that's going to block pain in the stomach by blocking acid secretion, I know that's going to work. So I'm going to get that drug. And then I'm going to market the hell out of it to tell the world that it's better than anything else that's ever gotten out there. And that's my business model. We need to look at patent law. We need to say, look, we have a model for this. We had something called the Orphan Drug Act. For those diseases that were rare, we said to the companies, we'll give you more market exclusivity when you finally get that drug on the market. Well, what we should say is, for these chronic diseases like Alzheimer's, like type 2 diabetes, like obesity, the things that are driving healthcare costs, we're going to give you extended patent life or market exclusivity. It doesn't matter how long it takes you, but once you get it on the market, we'll give you 12 years.
So there's the issue with the business model. I see that piece of it. You mentioned Alzheimer's disease, and I want to make sure we make time to talk about that, considering your expertise. You know, Americans are living longer. About 6 million people in the U.S. have Alzheimer's disease.
What do you think the right strategy is? Focusing on managing Alzheimer's? I'm sure you'd like to see a cure for it, but where should the focus be?
There is a new window of opportunity in Alzheimer's. We now know through brain scans, and we also know through looking at your cerebrospinal fluid, and we will shortly know by looking at something in your blood, that you are developing the kind of pathology in your brain that is Alzheimer's disease. It's for 20 years before you get symptoms, we're beginning to see brain changes that we can document. That means there's a new window of opportunity to intervene. If we can slow that progression for 20 years before people are symptomatic, then instead of average age getting it at age 80, average age is going to get it at age 100. And we're all going to be a lot better off. So we have that window of opportunity now to intervene early before people are symptomatic. Problem goes back to what I was previously referring to. Those are very long studies with very novel drugs that are going to give very little patent life at the end of those studies.
The interesting thing, in a way, is that it almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it almost sounds like you're asking us to have a little bit more empathy for big pharma, for what it takes to bring these drugs to market.
No, I don't want to have empathy for them at all. I want to incentivize them in the right way. I think the incentives now are for me-too drugs. And that's because of how patent law is. I think this country has to understand that pharmaceuticals are not semiconductors. Everything doesn't work the same way for patents. And there is a common good that the pharmaceutical industry must preserve in what they do. But that common good will not be met unless the public, through legislation, understands that they need certain incentives in order to develop those drugs that we need the most.
As the Democratic candidates begin to shake out, I wonder who you see as, and I'm not trying to presume your politics, but I wonder who you see among them, just specifically, as being the most forward-thinking about the future of health. You know, Joe Biden has said that one of his moonshot goals would be to eventually eliminate cancer. Who do you think has the biggest moonshot ideas about the future of health right now?
Well, I've listened to Joe Biden talk, and I know because of his son's death, he's been deeply affected by the problems that we need to solve in medicine. And that might give him a very empathic understanding of what we need to do. I watch the candidates at the far left talk about Medicare for all and eliminating, you know, having a single payer system. And I think, you know, I wish you'd have the nuance to understand what that means. I just hope that at some point they begin to look at how complicated the situation is and sit down with the right people to advise them on the nuances that have to be looked at so we don't have the unintended consequences of bad legislation and bad public policy like we sometimes have had.
This is a question I hope you never have to answer in real life, but you talked about some of the economic challenges that Mount Sinai faced and the effort to try to grow your way out of the problems rather than cut your way out. If you had to start cutting, where would you cut first?
Oh, we always cut too. We always do. We look at our full-time equivalents, the number of people we employ, what they're doing. We are swarming with the kind of engineering of our services that we're always looking to be more efficient because we have to be. But there will come a time when that's just not possible anymore.
Before I let you go, on the flip side of that, if the economics of the Mount Sinai medical system were perfect, if you did not have to worry about reimbursements or full-time equivalents or any of that stuff, what would your moonshot be? What would you be aiming for if money was not an object?
I would like very effective, easy access for every patient. It kills me to see that patients sometimes have to wait for their care. So I'd make access much more effective. I'd be able to make sure that we spent every last possible cent to be leaders in safety and quality. And I would invest heavily through our medical school in the kind of innovation that will bring the therapeutics of tomorrow.
And when you say safety and quality, you mean just in terms of the hospital environment being safe, or what do you mean by that?
We want to keep people well. We are changing our contracting to something called value, which is like per capita payment, instead of fee for service, which is being paid for everything we do. Whenever we do something, we get paid. In that system, I need a cadre of new people to be in the community working with the patients with the most sickness, the most burden, and to make sure that they take their meds, that they eat the right foods, that they get exercise, that their air that they breathe is clean, that their house is a safe place to live in, and that they can get to their physician. To do that, you need community workers, you need case managers, you need people on the ground in the community interfacing with those people. So to keep people well, I need an army of new kinds of people who we have no reimbursement pattern for right now. If we were printing money in our system, I'd have an army of those people keeping those people with the most disease burden well.
That's Dr. Kenneth Davis, president and CEO of the Mount Sinai Health System, a hospital network in New York with 7 campuses and nearly 40,000 employees. Thanks to the Aspen Ideas Festival for helping us connect with our guests. Today's conversations were produced by Paige Osborne with help from Bianca Martin and Lindsay Foster Thomas. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. You'll find more discussions like these on the 1A podcast. You can subscribe on the NPR One app or whatever app you like. We'd love it if you'd write us a review. And if you're new to podcasting, you'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.